One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century, then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
Anybody who can actually say they were connected with the Bionic Woman, or V, or Alien Nation, or Short Circuit 2, or, well, $6 Million Man, or Incredible Hulk, any one of those, and you've earned the right to immortality. If you think...
I
shall continue with this introduction. If you then include the Darwin variant, probably the greatest epic novel I've actually just sort of been working my way through, in terms of it's got everything in there that's just right for our coronavirus pandemic based days. Also marvelous things as well. Ace novelist, multi-award winning person. We are so delighted to welcome to the Midweek Drive that awesome writer, producer, director, Kenneth Johnson. Welcome to the Midweek Drive, sir. How are you?
I'm exhausted just listening to the introduction, you know. But thank you, Alex, very much. That's very nice. And Tessa, it's lovely to meet you.
Lovely to meet you.
And right off the bat, we have to say that we'll dispense with Kenneth because that was my father's name, and I was a junior, so he was always Kenneth, and I was always Kinney, pronounced by my Arkansas relatives as K-I-N-N-Y, Kinney. And so I've always been Kenny to my cast and family and friends, and at least that's what they call me to my face, you know. So Kenny, by all means.
But Kenny, it will jolly well. Over the last 15, 20 years or so, we've had lots of connections with Los Angeles, including, as I say, a mutual connection, which kind of has its roots in Harve Bennett, because, of course, Harve Bennett's one of his co-producers on the Mod Squad was Arthur Weingarten. And as Tessa will say, Arthur Weingarten and, of course, his wonderful wife, Annette Andre, regulars on the Midweek Drive. And so, accordingly, it's been a case of every so often, you know, your name's cropped up and I thought, yes, etc. And just looking back over your body of work, I mean, first of all, you haven't actually received this award as yet, Ken, but I think it's important that we should have a special Kenny Johnson Award for most incisive, entertaining, and valuable DVD commentaries. Whether those commentaries are for Alien Nation, for The Bionic Woman, for The $6 Million Man, for The Incredible Hulk, they're probably the best DVD commentaries I've ever heard. They give you an insight into the filmmaking procedures. They talk about the whole range of things relating from poor man's process, through shots, through insights. The Incredible Hulk Married episode, Tessa, I know you're a big fan of The Incredible Hulk. That in particular is one which the insight into the trauma that Bill Bixby was going through behind the scenes of the series, it's phenomenal. Worth getting from that alone, really. So kudos from that perspective. And also kudos from another mutual colleague, Gary Garani, who actually was very delighted when you actually sort of gave the introduction to his text, the top 100 comic book movies. And of course, Incredible Hulk is actually in there at number 26. So I feel as though destiny has kind of finally brought us together, Kenny, after so many sort of years of saying, wow, this individual has just produced so many awesome soundtracks and memories of our youth.
Thanks a lot. It's funny, when I did the first commentary I did was for my miniseries V. And before I did it, I went and listened to a bunch of other commentaries. And a lot of them were just so unbearably awful. The person would be sitting there saying, well, now he's moving from the right side of the screen to the left side of the screen. It's like, yeah, tell me something that I don't know. Tell me why you were there. Tell me where you were shooting. Tell me what cameras you were using. Tell me what rehearsing you did. And I also don't enjoy the ones where they're sitting around just talking about how they love every scene. You know, it's like, yes, this is my favorite scene. Oh, right. And except for the last one, then the next one. And so when I set out to do V, the commentary, I really wanted to make it something that, because I listened to some really good ones also, including Ronnie Howard's for Apollo 13, which was terrific, or Ridley's for Alien, which is really wonderful also, and very, very detailed. And so I really sat down with all my crew lists and all of my notes, and really wanted to make it I figure if somebody was going to sit and bother to listen for an hour or two to this guy talking, he better say something that was really going to give them some stuff. And that's what I've tried to do in all of the commentaries. And I've fortunately received a lot of nice comments from folks about it. And I just finished my most recent one, which is a full-length director commentary for Short Circuit 2, which is now out in the UK, actually. It's first come out in the UK. You can get it on Amazon in UK. And it's actually a special collector's edition where they've got a little booklet in there, a lot of photos. And I was frustrated when Sony put out the original DVD of Short Circuit and then the later Blu-ray, because they never bothered to call and say, hey, would you like to, do you have any yada yada? And so when I got this call this time from the folks in the UK, I said, well, sure, I'm happy to do a full-length commentary. There's a lot of wonderful stories about the making and turning of this little bag of bolts into a creature. But by the way, would you be interested in the 3 hours of rehearsal video that I have with me and Johnny and the actors, and about the gag reel with all of the outtakes? How about the 200 photos behind the scenes that I've got, as well as the storyboards? Anyway, all of that is packed into this new release of the Short Circuit 2 Blu-ray, which has just come out. And it's really the most thorough, I think, that I've ever been able to do on any special features thing. So
I'm sold. I'll be there. I mean, apart from the fact, and I'll bring Tessa in on this one. I mean, Tessa, surely in terms of influence, number 5 is alive. Johnny 5, is that not a wonderful precursor to Wall-E? I mean, surely. No Johnny 5, no Short Circuit 2. There would not have been a Wall-E.
And I loved Wall-E. I thought it was simply brilliant. And the combination of heart and humanity and Chaplin-esque comedy was really brilliant. But of course, the first thing I said was, that's Johnny's face. It really was. And Johnny's face, of course, came courtesy of not only of Eric Allard, who built the robot, but particularly the puppeteers that Jim Henson introduced to me, Rob and Gordon and Trish, who brought Johnny to life. And going back over it and going back through the movie again after all these years and remembering, and I talked to all of them again recently too, just to say, hey, tell me stories that you guys may remember that I don't. And that's all blended into this new commentary. But also I mentioned in the commentary the very strange thing that happened when we wrapped. And that was that when you make a movie and you spend months and months with people, you make friends and sometimes close friends for life. And you stay in touch with them, for as long as everybody's around. But the moment that we said wrap and Johnny said goodbye for the last time in the gag reel, actually, Johnny was gone. I woke up the next morning and I realized
no disassemble.
No, he wasn't. He was. It was like hearing that a young friend had been killed in an automobile accident. Because he was just gone. I could still talk to Rob, Gordon, Trish, and Eric, but Johnny was the manifestation of all of them working together that brought him to life. And I really went through a considerable period of mourning afterwards because he was so vital and so alive and so spontaneous that it was just hard to believe that he could have been gone. And it was It was a real sadness that I had to go through afterwards.
There's a really poignant scene in Short Circuit 2. Again, I was watching it recently. I saw it as a double bill with Short Circuit and Short Circuit 2. And it's the sequence where Johnny 5 effectively goes into the confessional in the Catholic Church. And that I thought was so poignant. That if anybody was actually asked to point out quintessential Kenneth Johnson direction and quality, I think that whole sequence actually had it in terms of the notion of humanity and a maker and seeking, and obviously the rejection that you get as well there.
Well, that's it. And that's, of course, a testimony to Steve Maddox and Steve Wilson and Brent Maddox, who wrote who created Johnny and who wrote the script, and that we really worked hard at. When Jeff Sagansky first offered me the picture, Jeff was president of TriStar. We were old friends from, he had been a vice president at NBC when I did V, and we'd been trying to get something to do together. And he called me and he said, take a look at this script for Short Circuit 2. And I said, And he said, no, just read it. And I looked through it and I thought, wow, this is a great opportunity here. But I said, Jeff, you're missing a very key element. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, this is a very funny picture and a lot of funny things, but your leading man is really being used more like a prop than a real character that we could really dig into. And because what you've really got here is the Elephant Man. And Jeff said, what are you talking about? This is a little comedy about a robot, you know? And I said, yeah, but it's like Quasimodo. People can't see past the surface of the creature to see what's really inside. As with the Elephant Man, he had the real character, the really was an Elephant Man who would say, I am a man, but people couldn't see into that. And I said, let me dig into that aspect of the script and work with Steve and Brent to really bring out all of that deep-seated humanity. And I think we can have a movie that won't lose any of the humor. All of the jokes and the sight gags and everything will still be there, but we'll have something that people really are drawn into. And it happened with us even as we were making the picture, and we got to the scene where we had to have Johnny beaten up and brutalized so horribly. And that was a very, very difficult day of filming for all of us on the set, because by then we'd been working together for a couple of months, and he was a living, breathing creature. And to watch him be decimated like that was...
I mean, no spoilers, Tessa, but if you haven't seen the movie, when you reach that particular sequence, it is awesome. It's tremendous.
I've got to shut my eyes then, because I will get attacked.
No, you have to go through it, because it comes out the other side and Johnny is ultimately triumphant, but it's not without.
He becomes a citizen of the United States. It's fantastic.
That, yes. Standing.
He should have been president as opposed to Trump. That's all I will say.
And he becomes, it's funny because he becomes a citizen, and the place we were shooting in Toronto, and we were filming in front of the provincial capital where they refused to take down the Canadian flags. So what we had to do was put up a bunch of American flags in front of them and have a wind machine off to the side so that the flags would be blowing and hiding the English flags behind them, you know, so... It was very fun.
Those Canadians. Anyway. Let's move on, Kenny, if we can, and I'll bring Tessa in, because I know, Tessa, you surprised me a few weeks ago when we were doing a Resonance Rewind, and you were very excited when we were doing The Incredible Hulk, the pilot episode, of course. I'd initially thought, oh, you're obviously a Mark Ruffalo fan, you're probably a sort of an Avengers, you'd come to it from that sort of perspective. But no, you said it was the original series. This was the one that really... kind of floated your boat from that point. I mean, Tessa, just share with us, what was it about that pilot that really kind of captured you and still does capture your kind of wonderment?
Well, obviously I watched it when I was a little girl. My mum and dad watched the series and we had it on a lot. And I just remember I was always so amazed by this big green Hulk, just the way he could rip his shirt and turn into this massive green man. For me, as a little girl, surprisingly, it didn't scare me. I found it amazing. And I get scared by a lot of things. And I just think the whole concept of the series is so different, so unique. And I think even if you're not a fan of any superheroes or sci-fi or any of that, you know, I think anybody can be a fan of this. And I know so many people that have seen it and watched it. And I think that's what's great about the Hulk. It brings everybody together. It's fantastic.
Well, thank you very much. I'm flattered and honored that you feel that way. And it's certainly what I set out to do. I had no interest in getting involved with comic booky kind
no
of
spandex,
projects.
No spandex.
Yes, no spandex. No primary colors. Yes. But I was. I mean, you may know this the backstory a bit of that. I was really trying to tell Frank Price, who was the head of Universal Pictures, no, I don't want to do that. But I was at home that night thinking it over, and my wife Susie, had the most literate person I've ever known, except for our daughter Katie, who had given me a novel that I had never read before called Les Misérables. And I was so in the middle, I was in the middle of Jean Valjean and trying to escape from the intrepid Inspector Javert, who was determined to bring him back, you know. And I realized, maybe there is a way to take a little bit of Victor Hugo and a little bit of Robert Louis Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde and this ludicrous thing called The Incredible Hulk and turn it into a psychological drama that was really in the classic Greek tradition, where the hero, because of his hubris, his own self-confidence, he brings down the curse upon himself, and the gods don't like it when you do that. And that's the core of Greek classic tragedy. And I thought, okay, well, this scientist should be a man who was trying to tamper with the things better left to the gods, you know, and I realized that I could do it as a as an adult drama. I was not looking for the kids audience. I was looking to play to adults. I was looking to create a show that I would watch, you know, as an adult. And that's where it came from. And I went back to Universal and said, okay, I will do it if you buy into my concept. And it's my casting. I don't want to have some actor shoved down my throat that I don't want. And I want something in return. Okay, Ken, what would you like in return? And I said to Frank, okay, look, I've always wanted to do a big miniseries of Ivanhoe, Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, great novel of the 1200s. The Robin Hood is a supporting player, and it's knighthood, and it's all this wonderful romantic adventure. And our deal was I would do the Hulk pilot and the series if it went to a series. But in return, I would get, you know, the Ivanhoe miniseries. And I wrote the pilot for The Incredible Hulk script in just 7 days, start to finish, because I just saw it in my head and put it on the paper. It was all on a yellow legal pad, which was how I was writing. And we shot what we call the white pages, which is the first draft of the script. And Bill Bixby came the only actor I ever sent it to. If you ever have a chance to see and you can get it, I think, on Amazon, there's a television play Bill did in 1973 called Steam Bath, where he is among a group of people that find themselves in a steam bath, and nobody quite remembers how they got there, and there doesn't seem to be an exit. And slowly we begin to realize that it's purgatory, and the little Puerto Rican steam bath attendant who is bringing everybody the towels and stuff, you know, he's God. And I remember seeing that in 73, and I was so impressed with Bill Bixby's performance. It just blew me away. And everything that he did in Steam Bath is what he brought to the Hulk. And we did it. And interestingly, Tess, it became I got a call from Universal one day, and they said, congratulations, you have the top grossing motion picture in Europe. I said, what? And they said, yes, we released your Incredible Hulk pilot as a film in theaters in Europe, and it's the top grossing movie in Europe. Okay. And it was for a couple of months. It was wonderful that it really struck a chord. And then when we did Married, the sequel later on in the second season, they released that overseas as a foreign theatrical as well, with the wonderful title of The Bride of the Incredible Hulk. Oh my God, not my title, but it did really, really well as well. And I think that helped to really get its teeth into the overseas audience at the time.
And it also suggested, Kenny, that wonderful sort of notion of the influence, because the line that wraps up Married, when the little child actually says, she's really not dead just as long as we remember her, exactly word for word appears in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, when McCoy says to Kirk, he's really not dead, not so long as we remember him. You see, half Bennett was paying attention.
There you go. Well, the line, of course, that everybody, it became part of the vernacular, was don't make me angry. You know, you wouldn't like me when I'm angry. And it's funny because, and I think I mentioned this in the commentary, and you may have heard it, that was take two. The one that you saw on the screen was take two. In take one, Bix came out and he was playing angry in the scene. He was shuffling Jack
McGee. Mr. McGee, don't make me angry.
I said, stop, cut, fix. I went up and whispered in his ear, it's a joke. He said, oh. And then he went back and came out with that marvelous little twinkle that just captured it. And it's funny, one quick little side story. When they had the premiere of the Ang Lee version of The Incredible Hulk, which was so miscast as far as directing is concerned. I mean, brilliant director, but not for that movie. And the script was, well, anyway, but it was really awful. And at the end of the premiere, as the lights came up, everybody was kind of trying to sneak out, you know, and it's in myself and I had nothing to do with the movie, right? But as I'm leaving, one of the Variety, I think, reporters grabbed my sleeve and said, "Mr. Johnson, don't make me Ang Lee. You wouldn't like me when I'm Ang Lee." And I thought, oh, okay.
I mean, you know, in some ways, Kenny, that could have been one of the kind of vaudevillian lines you could have put in. I mean, I love the sort of way in which you could always insert the occasional humour. I mean, I cite Lindsay Wagner's take and Lee Majors in the Bionic Woman episode of The $6 Million Man. Will I be able to play the violin again? That's good, because I couldn't play it before.
Right, yes. Well, then Richard Anderson's favourite line from The Bionic Woman, of course, was when Jamie was disguised as a nun, and who was obviously sort of miraculous as far as the other nuns were concerned. And at one point she has blocked his way into the monastery for some reason. And she had one of the nuns herd a flock of sheep on the street so that he couldn't get his car in. And he steps out of the car and takes off his glasses and says, "Sister, you've got to get the flock out of here."
Genius.
And I remember Richard saying, "Kenny, they're never going to let me say that." I said, "Bet they will." and we snuck it past the broadcast standards. We always enjoyed doing that whenever we could.
It's always critical. I mean, we could go into a range of things. Tessa, any questions you'd like to put to Kenny about The Incredible Hulk? We can see him there, a young Kenny Johnson sandwiched between Lou and, of course, Bill in the background.
I look like such a fool in that four photograph. That's one that always comes up, and I think I look a little bit like Doc in Back to the Future, you know? It's crazy. But anyway, Tess, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you must have so fond memories of writing and creating and directing and everything of the Hulk. I mean, have you got a specific moment in time that you really remember? I don't know whether it's from the writing or behind the scenes on the set. Is there anything specific that comes to mind? I know it's one of those questions, you know, it's cliche, but it's always nice to know a little bit of background.
Sure. Well, there were a couple of moments. There's a photo on my wall back up in there.
A lot there.
And it's a picture of, it's a two shot of me and Bill side by side, and he's got the white eyes in. And that was the very first time he put the white eyes in. We were up at the California Institute of the Arts where we were filming some of the laboratory sequences. And I had heard from makeup that the contact lenses had come in, and we'd rehearsed, and I said, "Okay, look, while I get the setup squared away, why don't you go see how the, you know, try them on and see how they fit." And so about 10 minutes later, I hear from behind me, "Hey, Kenny." And I turn around, and walking toward me is big television movie star Bill Bixby with his big grin and these white eyes. And I remember saying, "Son of a bitch, this show is a hit." You know? And there was one other time where it happened too, in the course of where I had the same feeling. And that was when we were at St. Joseph's Hospital in Santa Monica, I think it was. And he was getting into the machine, which was a real machine to, for MRIs and stuff. And the little crosshairs appeared on his forehead. I said, "Oh, yeah, this is gonna work." That combined with Bill's performance and also the performance of Susan Sullivan, Tessa, because yes. I mean, she's our voice and our eyes in the piece, and we were so lucky to have cast her. Because when I look at it again nowadays, I am just blown away by her insight and her human and her realistic performance that makes the whole piece realistic. You know,
You really do connect the characters and everything. It is very realistic. You almost kind of want everything in it to be true and be real. It really does. I don't know. It's fantastic. I've got to say, it's very, very gripping. And did you always see yourself as a writer or a director? I mean, growing up as a child, you must have had such an imagination. Did you ever see yourself as doing this role, doing this job?
Well, it's interesting. I was doing it, and I didn't realize I was at a very young age. I was in it was the summer between my eighth and ninth grade year of high school. I had saved up my money and bought a tape recorder. And for a while, I just did lots of recording and making sounds and all of that sort of stuff and some music and that kind of thing too. But at the same time, I was reading, and in a book of short pieces, I came across a script that had been written for Orson Welles. And it was the 1939 radio script of War of the Worlds. And I thought, wow, this is so cool. It was a radio play. And so I got my little ninth grade friends together in my living room and cast them all. I saved the Orson Welles role for myself. we made a radio play and recorded it on my recorder. And
did you panic America, Kenny? Did you panic America? No, did you get those people saying the Martians are coming?
No, but I thrilled. I took it in and played it for one of my teachers. And she said, this is great. You got to play it for the class. And it soon all of the classes wanted to have it. You know, so I very quickly became known as the drama guy in my high school, you know. And I, by the way, I was also known as the guy who carried a briefcase. You know, so because I was way ahead of the game. Now they have rollers and backpacks and stuff. But, you know, in my day, everybody was carrying armfuls of books. And I said, I saw my stepfather had an old briefcase. I said, can I have that? But at any rate, I was doing it without realizing it. And then when I was in the 10th grade, because I had become known as the drama guy, they asked me if I would play Scrooge in A Christmas Carol at our Christmas show that year. And I thought, sure, of course, why not? I'll try to do that. And it was a normal sort of condensed version of A Christmas Carol made for high schools and like that. And it was good and substantial, but it just ended without, and I'm thinking, this needs more of a better ending. And I came across a recording that Noel Coward had made of A Christmas Carol. And he had this little soliloquy that he said at the end of it, about a minute and a half long. It just tied it all together. And I went to my co-drama teacher and I said, hey, can I do this at the very end? The curtain closes, I'll come out and just this little thing. And she said, yeah. I said, okay, that's cool. But it needs music too, you know? So you see what's happening, Tess. I'm already thinking like a producer without realizing that's what I'm doing, or director. And I went to the choral department, but the 60 voice chorus was going to be at the Christmas show. And I said, what music are you going to be doing? And they showed me and I said, okay, how about this one? Take this one. And when the curtain closes, just start going. And it was Oh Holy Night. And I said, but don't sing the words, just go do, 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 right? And I will come out and deliver my little piece. And I said, and I could read music because I'd studied music. And I said, okay, now when you get to this point, you sing, everybody comes in and sings. So the curtain closes, I walk out with my beard and my eyes huge, you know, and they just start going do, 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 do. And I go, well, that was a Christmas for you. And I may tell you that Tiny Tim did not die. He's alive and growing stronger day by day. Fine boy. Now, I still know every word of it because every Christmas when I'm in an elevator and Oh Holy Night starts playing, I start doing my bit. All right, so we do it. And I timed it so that I got to, and so as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone. And right at that point, the 60 voices go, fall on your knees, oh, hear thee. And I was electrified, Tess. And I went backstage and I was leaning against the wall and my little heart was just going pity-pat. And I thought, I have to be in the theater. And I realized I had found my home. And from then on, it was a straight shot, and I knew what I wanted to do. Film came later. I knew it was theater that I wanted to do. And I went into Carnegie Tech, which was now Carnegie Mellon University, the drama department, which was you had to audition for, and 1,500 people auditioned, and like, you know, 90 of us got in. But I began to have a feeling of, okay, this is, I can do this, and I really want to do this, and I want to be a director, producer, writer. I didn't think of writer at that time. Writer came much, much later. I was not very good as a writer and never did think I was. But my friend Stephen Bochco, who was a classmate at Carnegie and later at Universal, he got his foot in the door and got my foot in the door at Universal. And he convinced me that if I could write, you know, I could be able to find my path to directing. Because when you're a writer, you can write on spec. You know, you don't have to get paid and host somebody that'll buy it. And maybe if they like it enough, they'll let you direct. If you're an actor, you can do bit parts like every actor did and work their way up. But if you're a director, they either give you the money to direct or they don't. And they don't usually do it until you've done it for somebody else already. So it's like, how do you make that happen? So it was challenging, but writing was my way in.
Well, I'd certainly sort of promote the Darwin variant as an absolute epic. And I love the way, actually, Kenny, you kind of also have the characters. It's almost as though you've written it partly as a film script. You've even, I mean, the audio version as well has got multiple voices in terms of this sort of text, which certainly in terms of recent novels is a classic, really, and is well worth accessing. Any plans to actually shoot it as a movie? Is it up for possibilities?
Well, obviously, that's always in the back of my head, is how can I turn something into a film? And we're looking at that. Also, the novel that I wrote before the Darwin variant, which is The Man of Legends, which became actually a big bestseller on Amazon, is also the audio version is also like that. Like, I'm back to my radio play days. And it was great fun doing the audios because I brought in all my favorite actors and friends to do all the voices. And so, yes, whenever I write anything, it's with an eye toward how can I get onto the set, because that's what I enjoy the most. Writing is wonderful and you can do it by yourself, but then you're by yourself. And what I enjoy the most, Alex and Tess, is the sensuality of being in a room with people where I can actually reach out and touch them and where I'm getting all of their ideas and feedback and input, as Johnny would say, input to make the project better. And it's so collaborative and so much fun. Directing is way more fun to me than writing is.
Input. Let's go to, I mean, we're jumping around a bit here. There's so much to actually work through. I feel as though there's an epic series here. But let's go to, again, the thing that initially brought you, I think, to the broader public's attention. And certainly as a young man, this was something which I was very impressed with, because it was a time where, for me, in one's teenage years, you really had a very emotive scenario. The two-part episode of The $6 Million Man, end of season two, more or less, entitled The Bionic Woman. Not only do you hear Lee Majors sing, and I've had mixed feelings about that over the years. I mean, I just don't know.
Sweet Jamie, I remember it well, yeah. Lee always talked a little bit like he was constipated, you know? Hey, Kenny, how are we going to do this? You know, anyway, go ahead, Alex, sorry.
I mean, Tessa hosts our regular country music show, so I think she would appreciate Lee Majors singing. Jamie, I love you forever. all sorts of things. The only two songs I've ever heard from him, from his point of view. But it was something which really, it had an emotional resonance, something which was also echoed. You mentioned, obviously, The Incredible Hulk, by the death, of course, of the character Valena in The Incredible Hulk. In this particular instance, obviously, there was that also the demise, although I gather that originally you had warned, or you had suggested to the suits, you didn't just want love story. You don't want to go with love story. This could be a real character that could actually have spin-offs and all sorts of things. Don't kill her.
I said, yes, I did say that they really wanted me to kill her off. And I said, that's a mistake. And they said, no, we don't want a lot of bionic people running around. No, kill her off, dead. I said, okay, cerebral hemorrhage, and, you know, and bye-bye. And then what happened was, the Bionic Woman two-parter was a very, very different kind of show than $6 Million Man had ever done before, because they were always sort of mission-oriented and go in there, Steve, and, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And I said from the beginning to Harv, it really needs to be a love story that, and it's got to be a personal story, and it's got to be really focused on that. And it was, it took me like three drafts for them to finally realize that I was right and let me do what I wanted to do. And I said, we should leave her alive. And they didn't, and she died in the rain and in slow motion. And I was, you know, okay, moving on. And by then, Harvard asked me to join $6 Million Man as a writer producer. I said, sure, if I can.
No direct. Kenny Johnson, no Bigfoot, let's face it.
That's right, there's that, and which could work in both directions, either good or bad. But the reaction from the letters that started pouring in after she died, really made the network and the studio sort of think twice. And they really thought three times when they looked at the ratings, because the $6 million man ratings suddenly went up considerably. And so they came back to me and said, yeah, why'd you kill her anyway, Kenny? That was a dumb idea. You know, let's bring her back. Okay. And at the end of the summer, the original Bionic Woman two-parter aired. And at the end of the second one, it said, tune in next week for the return of the Bionic Woman. Mm-hmm. And of course, everybody in America did. And suddenly it was spun off into another series. And for a while, I was writing and producing both series at the same time, which is really like living in a garbage disposal. And I was not having time to direct like I wanted to. So I finally said, look, I got to let go of one of these. And Lee was not happy, but I said, look, Lee, I got to go with my own baby here and try to keep going. So that's, you know, that's what I did. And it was great. I've always looked at those years as sort of graduate school with pay, Alex, and that I was very lucky to be able to have sort of been nurtured by Harv and encouraged by Steve Bochco to write, because I discovered that I actually could, and I could write pretty fast, which is what's really important when you're doing television stuff. So it was really, really a good and wonderful time. And one thing I want to say before we run out of time and it gets lost, because I know you're involved with the school and all like that. And one of the things that my film students always, I know, want to know, they say, yeah, we love hearing all your war stories and everything, but how do I get a job? And on my website is a little handout that I give to them. If people who are interested, go to my website, which is just kennethjohnson.us. And you click on filmmaking class. You'll see about the filmmaking class and the seminars that I do, but at the very bottom, there's a little link that says getting a gig. And this is a handout that I give to all of my students, because it is a condensation of all of the information and ideas that I can suggest about how do you get a job in this business. And so I wanted to make sure that that people knew how to access that. So if they have interest in trying to work in the business and they've got some chops, here's the place to go.
Kenny, there are so many sort of avenues that we yet have to explore. I mean, there's the role of Michael Marchetti, and did you feel sympathy with Michael Marchetti in The Return of the Bionic Woman? We've got obviously another series, which is a guilty pleasure of mine, which he directed some of my favorite episodes of, including Friendly Fire. Of course, that's JAG with the Don Belisario scenario there. And JAG, I think, worked very well and opens up a whole range of things. There's heaps of other things with respect to V, etc. But as you say, time has caught up with us, so I need to put two final questions to you at this moment in time. First of all, Kenny, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on this your Midweek Drive debut?
I've been delighted to be here with you. It's always fun, and particularly to meet people like you and Tess, who are not just fans, but people who have really dug into the material and have really substantive thoughts and ideas. And it's just so rewarding to me to be able to get that kind of feedback from people like you.
Well, I do have a pet theory, of course, in terms of why, despite the fact you were arguing for it being the Red Hulk as or red as opposed to green, surely with Bill Bixby actually cutting his teeth with Ray Walston in My Favorite Martian, Martians tend to be green. So it was inevitable he'd end up working with another green individual. It's the cosmos, surely.
It was so frustrating. Stan Lee and I went around and around about that, because I said, Stan, the color of rage is red. You know, they only made him green because they could make a good green color. The printer told them that. It had nothing to do with. I said, Stan, it's not organic. I'm trying to do the real stuff, real life, as much as I can here. And that's why I changed his name from Bruce Banner, because I was trying to get away from Peter Parker, Lois Lane, Lex Luthor, the comic book alliteration, you know. That was one battle that I lost, and you know, I still have green smudges on old sweatshirts from my days of working with Lou.
I'm still waiting to see your take on Ivanhoe. I'm sure Roger Moore and Anthony Andrews will actually sort of pale in significance. That's the key thing. So the next critical question is, Kenny Johnson, will you be kind enough to return? Can we prevail upon you to connect with us again in the not too distant future? Will you come back with us?
Well, let me think about that, Alex. Okay.
Genius. If I think we need to work on yourself and Arthur Weingarten and all sorts of other things together. Kenny Johnson, writer, producer, director, awesome, living legend. Take care.
Thank you. Take care. Thanks, Jess.
Non nocere is, as far as I recall, from the Hippocratic Oath, translated as, first of all, do no harm, to which you could also possibly add the Latin aphorism, prestine lente, make haste slowly. Both of those key things are very valid when we start talking about how we're going to get back to some form of normality. And it's fair to say the rest of the world, many countries are actually watching Britain in particular with respect to what's happening, given the lifting of restrictions and so on and so forth. Well, we need to actually have some proper sage advice with respect to this, not the scientific advisory group kind, but the official advice of a medic who's very much at the front line of matters to do with COVID and why vaccinations are such an important part of our day-to-day life. And so we're delighted to welcome back to the programme the awesomely talented Dr. Amir Khan. How are you, Amir?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me back.
Always a delight. Now, as we said, it's clearly we've got a range of issues that are coming through as far as the roadmap is concerned and the way in which we're heading through from that point of view. But it's fair to say we don't want to all go crazy on this particular aspect. Otherwise, all of the good work of the last 15, 16 months could well be just flushed down the pan.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, we've all made sacrifices. It's been tough over the last 18 months or so. And now with restrictions easing and entering, you know, we're entering into this phase four of easing of restrictions, we still need to practice those healthy behaviours that we've been doing for so long that have kind of become second nature to a lot of us. So despite it, you know, it may not be law anymore, there are still things that we have to encourage to reduce the spread of coronavirus because we know cases are going up. And it's the kind of things we've been doing already, like I say, wearing a mask when you can't socially distance or if you're in enclosed public spaces, really, really important. Washing your hands regularly. If you've got no symptoms, then taking twice weekly rapid flow tests. All of us should be doing that. And then if you have got symptoms, no matter how mild, and oh my God, I have conversations with my patients about this all the time, you know, when they ring up or say, oh, I've got this symptom, I've got that symptom. And I went, well, it could be COVID. And like, oh no, it's not COVID. Don't guess. Get a PCR test if you've got symptoms. Now, the weather's gorgeous, Alex. So everybody should be meeting outside. I mean, it's not often we get gorgeous weather like this. But if you are meeting inside, open windows and let fresh air in because it will blow away some of those viral particles that people might be breathing out if they haven't got any symptoms and they don't know they've got the virus. And we know one in three people don't know they've got the virus. They don't have any symptoms. So let fresh air in when you're inside. And really, really important, get vaccinated when you get called. It's so, so important.
And in terms of that vaccination process, I mean, again, I'm speaking as somebody who has had both vaccine slots now, so I'm immune from that point of view. But at the same time, why is it important to people who might be listening to this and they might have had one shot and then they've sort of thought, well, do I need a second one? I feel okay. And after all, I can't be coping with this pingdemic as well as pandemic and so on and so forth. Why would you say that's still important, Amir, to make sure you get both shots of the vaccine and, of course, maintain your standard good health practices afterwards?
Yeah, so there's a couple of points there. So when you get fully vaccinated, and that's having both doses of the vaccine, you're not necessarily immune to the virus. It just protects you against getting seriously ill, and it can reduce the risk of spreading the virus, even though it doesn't completely stop that risk of spreading the virus. So it's really important you get both shots. And now with this Delta variant being the most dominant variant here in the UK and spreading rapidly throughout the world, it's really important that both vaccines, you get both shots of the vaccine, because that is what protects you against getting seriously ill from the Delta variant. One vaccine offers you minimal protection against the Delta variant, if we're being brutally honest. It's a set of vaccines, it's two, you need both of them to get that full level of protection. And even after the vaccine, it's really important you practice those healthy behaviors that we talked about. And I understand this pandemic is, you know, stressing people out and causing days off work, but cases are going up. And the only way to kind of put a lid on it is to reduce the spread of this virus. And one of the ways that we do that is test, 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 trace, 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 isolate, isolate, isolate. And you might get pinged and it might be a pain in the behind, but if you're asked to isolate, please do so, because, you know, like I say, one in three people have no symptoms. So you might feel absolutely fine, but there's a reason you've been pinged. You've been in close proximity for more than 15 minutes with someone who's tested positive for the virus. So you've got to stay at home. You don't want to be spreading it around, because your spreading around could lead to someone getting the virus who gets seriously sick with it. And you don't want to be responsible for that.
Obviously, we heard of the BBC reporter who effectively had both doses of the vaccine, thought he was actually immune, went to the G7 conference and obviously picked it up immediately, which probably just says you should stay away from politicians, really. It's something I've often said. But in terms of the system, I mean, that's a good example, really, of how just because you've actually had both vaccine doses, it doesn't mean that you're immune. And clearly, you do still need to beware the potential of being a carrier, or indeed catching the contagion as well.
Yeah, I think it's important to say, like I've said before, it does reduce your risk of getting seriously ill. So if you know, it doesn't protect you completely from getting the virus again, but if you do, you're more likely to get mild symptoms. So it's really important that you take up these vaccines, both doses, when you get called. And younger people, we're really vaccinating younger people at the moment, and we've seen a drop off in numbers of people coming forward for it. And it may be that they think that they may not get the virus, or if they do, they won't get sick from it. But believe me, I am seeing people. I'm sitting here in clinic right now talking to you, and I know today at some point I will talk to someone with long COVID. It's happening on a daily basis, and they may have had mild symptoms. They may not have needed hospital treatment, but they now have symptoms that are going on and on and on. And those symptoms of long COVID include shortness of breath, palpitations, brain fog, fatigue, low mood, all of these things that, you know, perfectly healthy people go from being able-bodied, happy, healthy lives, and then to this awful long-term illness. And that can affect young people too. So yeah, you may not get seriously ill in the acute infection, but you can get long-term symptoms. And trust me, it's not worth having. Trust me, trust me, trust me.
As a practicing GP, as you mentioned, Dr. Amir, you're at the front line of this whole process. And it's fair to say that if we're talking about Delta variants, the variants, there is still an awful lot of potential Greek letters going all the way to Omega, really, which I presume could actually go. We haven't got the Gamma variant and such like. Do you think that actually in terms of the way in which this is impacting our lives in general, there is light at the end of the tunnel? Because, I mean, clearly vaccines were being hailed very much as the absolute almost panacea, the magic bullet at one stage. And yet it seems as though we're still having to be wary of the sort of areas that we're working within on our day-to-day experiences.
Yeah, I know it can feel like that. You know, people were waiting for the vaccine and then they're being told now, well, you've been vaccinated, but you've still got to adhere to these kind of healthy behaviours. So it's really important that you do. You know, we've managed to vaccinate a huge swathe of the adult population. There's still lots of people left to be vaccinated, and we have to hit a certain level of vaccinated and numbers to get that herd immunity. And that varies depending on which expert you speak to, between 70% and 85%. So it really does vary. And don't forget, we are going to be moving to vaccinate 12 to 15 year olds with the Pfizer vaccine who have underlying health conditions as well. And that will increase the number of people vaccinated and move us more towards that herd immunity. And it's key here, and it's worth just pointing out, that the protection you receive from vaccines is better and more kind of is longer lived than any protection you might get from getting the virus. So don't, if you've had symptoms of the virus and you think, oh, I don't need the vaccine, I've had the virus. Yes, you do need the vaccine. You get better protection, longer lasting protection. That's been proven in studies over and over again. And then the other point is, yes, you know, there might be more variants in the future. That's what booster shots may be used for in the future as well, if that's what it comes to. So we are working hard to try and keep ahead of the virus, if that's the right words. But you know, the vaccines are key, and until we get to those stages, wearing a mask, socially distancing, using the COVID-19 app, washing your hands regularly, fresh air indoors, meeting outdoors preferably, all of those things I talked about before are super important. So everything is interlinked. Everything will protect you and other people from the virus. We are in this together, and we've always been in this together. And the more of us who adhere to these healthy behaviors, who practice them, the lower the numbers of infections will be.
gov.uk/coronavirus will actually give you more information on the kind of areas we've been talking about. But if you wish to actually have more Dr. Amir Khan, and who wouldn't wish to have more Dr. Amir Khan? I noticed you're actually appearing in a video that people can access via YouTube as well for the Department for Health and Social Care.
I am. So all of this information that we've been talking about today is on the YouTube video, and it's really well illustrated on there as well. So just go to the Department of Health and Social Care's YouTube channel, and it's not just me talking. You'll see visuals of all of it, which is far better than just listening to me talk.
I don't know, Dr. Amir. I've always said the scenery is so much better on radio, but that's a different line entirely. We'll do that another time. For the moment, Dr. Amir Khan, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on. Be well and keep up the excellent work.
Cheers. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.